Okay, now I have the pleasure of introducing our second speaker. Dr. Pat Levitt is the Provost Professor of Neuroscience, Psychiatry, and Pharmacy at the University of Southern California. He's Director of the Program in Developmental Neurogenetics at the Institute for the Developing Mind at Children's Hospital in Los Angeles. His research focuses on the development of brain architecture and how genes and the environment increase the risk for neurodevelopmental disorders. In his own research, Dr. Levitt identified a gene that increases the risk for autism spectrum disorder. He's published over 190 scientific articles, 65 scholarly books, monographs, and reviews. He's presented his research at Congress, the National Conference of State Legislatures, the National Governors Association, and NATO. And he has produced so much research of such a high quality that he's earned the coveted Merit Awards from the National Institutes of Health and the National Institute of Mental Health. He was elected to the prestigious Institute of Medicine and is a scientific director with Jack Schoenkopf of the National Scientific Council on the Developing Child at Harvard that Dr. Rolnick referred to. In two decades, he's one of the most distinguished scholars I've brought to the seminars. I must tell you, he's been one of the very nicest to work with. Now, he became interested in early intervention because he grew up with a developmental disability. He stuttered severely, as did his father and his brother. Now, he began seeking assistance from a speech pathologist when he was 9. His brother began during the teen years, and his father never did. His father stuttered severely as an adult. His brother's speech improved, but Dr. Levitt's own speech now has no hesitation at all, as you will hear in just a moment. That experience sold him on the power of early intervention. His talk today is Toxic Stress and Its Impact on Early Learning and Health, Building a Formula for Human Capital Development. Let's welcome him.
Thank you very much, Karen. Is this on? Is this good?
Yep.
All right. So I just have to say I've gone to a lot of states and I've spoken a lot. I'm going to rename my talk, Why is Art Right? Art and I have spoken together several times. Now, he criticizes me terribly because he doesn't like me to use any slides at all. But I'm a scientist, and a scientist without slides is... I would feel completely naked. I do want to say one thing. Karen and I have never worked together, and you all know her, and I've just met her. She is one remarkable individual. So I've been doing science for a long time, but I'll say this: I think the thing that reflects my great intelligence is the following. I spent 4 years in Chicago as an undergraduate, and I knew I wanted to go into science, and not into medicine. You can hear my stutter a little bit, because my older brothers were physicians, and I didn't want to do anything that they were doing. So I decided to go to graduate school. So I had a choice between Boston, staying in Chicago, St. Louis, or La Jolla, California. So I went to the Farmer's Almanac. Does anyone know what the Farmer's Almanac is? We didn't have the internet at that time, and I looked at the average yearly temperature. And it was pretty clear that La Jolla was the choice. At that time, we didn't do any tours or anything like that. So that's how I ended up in San Diego. So today, I'm going to see if this is going to work. Here we go. Here we go. Okay, so this is a first fundamental. Does anybody disagree with this? Anybody raise your hand if you would disagree with this. A baby alone does not exist. This is the essence of why early matters, because babies during pregnancy, as they're developing, and then after birth, cannot and do not exist alone, right? Humans are incredibly social creatures, and we're built to interact with others and our environment. In fact, we depend upon it, and the brain depends upon it, and I'm going to talk about that. So this is what I think in the past the public has thought regarding child and brain development, that there's fate, stuff happens, there's free will, there's parents, genes, environment, somehow they get together in a black box, somebody shakes it up, and you get an unsuccessful or a successful child. And if you do the interview on the street, like Jay Leno does, sometimes you still get answers like this. Well, it's a mystery, but we'll never figure it out, but something happens, right? So I think it's changed dramatically. It's changed dramatically for a lot of reasons. I will say that Jack Shonkoff, in putting together the National Scientific Council of Developing Child, put together scientists, economists, that's where I met Art, and Jim Heckman from the Chicago Economic School, and others. And I have to say, developmental psychologists, it was a remarkably energetic time of all of us sitting around and talking about the intersection between brain science, economics, child and family development, and how this could really matter and change things in a big way. So I'm going to give you the punchlines first in case you either have to leave or I run out of time. So here's the core story. Child development is the foundation for prosperous communities. I don't have to expand upon that. Art did a beautiful job, as he always does. Brains are built over time from the bottom up. Skill begets skill, right? That's not a complicated. So has anybody coached little children in any sport or anything at all? Do you have them start off by playing a game? What do you have them start off? They want to play a game. Well, what do you start them off doing? Learning fundamental skills, right? And that's how the brain is built. The brain is built with simple circuits becoming able to do more complex things as more complex circuits get built, and that takes time. And by the way, it doesn't happen in one day or one year or several years, and different parts of the brain develop in different periods of time, and I'll talk about that. Genes and experience together build brains, and they're particularly important in what we call serve and return relationships. The interaction between individuals is critical for brain development. The brain is a miracle, right? I love my liver and kidney and heart, I do. But the brain is built to develop through interacting with its environment, taking in those experiences and further driving development. It's not just genes. It's this interaction. And in science, we don't debate about whether it's one or the other. Cognitive, social, and emotional development are inextricably intertwined. They're inseparable, and I'll show you why in a minute. So programs that focus on cognitive development in the absence of social and emotional development, improving those skill sets, will not work. Period. They will not work. And we have lots of data, by the way, on lots of programs that don't work because they didn't follow the way in which the brain actually develops and the way children develop. These skill sets have to be approached together. Toxic stress, I'll talk about it in a minute, damages brain architecture. There are physical changes to the brain, as Art talked about. Resilience, that is the ability to avoid bad outcomes when challenged with something like toxic stress, is not an internal character strength. It's not about rugged individualism, which is part of our culture. It's built through a combined impact of, yes, what you inherit from mom or dad, and the skills that you can build to be resilient when challenged. Right. For many functions, the brain's capacity for change decreases over time. That's Art's cost-effectiveness factor. Things change over time. Picking up a golf club or learning how to ice skate at the age of 25, believe me, right, is a challenge, will always be a challenge, and will never change. Right? You just will never be as good as if you started early. But not all functions are impacted equally by time, and we'll talk about that. So, policy changes based on neuroscience or brain development, what can they mean? Well, this is what they can mean. So if you invest early, you reduce special needs populations, for sure. So these are immediate returns, not just long-term returns. So in California, the cost per child in a special needs classroom is $55,000, $56,000 per year. Very expensive, right? The cost per child in a typical classroom is about $8,000, okay? So do the math. If you're a child who has toxic stress experiences, and the ACE study, which was done by the Kaiser Group, shows this. If you experience four or more adverse childhood experiences, toxic, your chances of being in a special needs classroom is almost 100%. So you can do the math. So invest early. There will be major increase in human capital for your ready workforce, and it's. And I would argue this. There's nothing more patriotic than what we're talking about today. There's a group called Ready Nation, made up of retired admirals, generals, et cetera. You guys have heard about this? So here's a statistic for you, which really is scary. 70% of young men between the ages of 17 and 25, 70% are ineligible to serve in the armed forces in this country. 70. Right? So if they're ineligible to serve in the armed forces, who's going to hire them? Right? So why is it so high? That translate that 30% can serve, right? No high school diploma, you're out. Incarceration early, you're out. Use of illicit substances, you're out. Obesity, you're out. Those four add them up, 70% of men, of young men between the ages of 17 and 25. Okay, so here's how the brain develops over time. This is what nerve cells look like at birth. They look like your garden when you first planted them. This is what happens in 6 years. We grow, we make about 700 nerve connections a second between the third trimester in utero and the age of three. About 700 nerve connections a second. So do the calculation. That's a lot of nerve connections. And then we go through a process that depends upon experiences of pruning those connections back that we don't really use very much. So this is a long process, right? Skills that develop earliest, you can guess, are those skills that we need to interact with our environment. Vision, hearing, touch, all the sensory systems and our motor systems develop early. But our social, emotional, and cognitive systems take a much longer period of time to develop. So here's a take-home reminder already. Development is not a blank slate. That is, children are not sponges. If I hear this one more time, right? My kindergarten teacher knew that I was not a sponge. I was in a fight every day, and I had ADHD, and I had all the things that would make a person a mess. The brain is built through experiences. You just can't sit a child, young or whatever age, in the middle of something and have information come at them and they learn it. It doesn't work that way. And by the way, it doesn't work for birds either. When a juvenile male bird has to learn their mating song, they don't learn it from listening to an audio recording of that song. They don't even learn it from hearing that song with a stuffed bird sitting on the same perch. It has to be a live tutor. This is birds, right? So that translates into how we learn as human beings. And remember, skill begets skill. A strong foundation increases odds for positive outcomes. And again.
The key to forming strong brain architecture is what's known as serve and return interaction with adults. In this developmental game, new neural connections form in the brain as young children instinctively serve through babbling, facial expressions, and gestures. And adults return the serve, responding in a very directed, meaningful way. It starts very early in life, when a baby coos and the adult interacts and directs the baby's attention to a face or hand. This interaction forms the foundation of brain architecture upon which all future development will be built. It helps create neural connections between all the different areas of the brain, building the emotional and cognitive skills children need in life. For example, here's how it works for literacy and language skills. When the baby sees an object, the adult says its name. This makes connections in the baby's brain between particular sounds and their corresponding objects. Later, adults show young children that those objects and sounds can also be represented by marks on a page. With continued support from adults, children then learn how to decipher writing and eventually to write themselves. Each stage builds on what came before. Ensuring that children have adult caregivers who consistently engage in serve and return interaction, beginning in infancy, builds a foundation in the brain for all the learning, behavior, and health that follow.
So, this is what brain growth looks like. This just came out. This is 2013. So, this is what the gray matter, this is a gray matter that contains all of the nerve cells, right? If you're 400% above the federal poverty line, that's what your growth curve looks like. This is months on the bottom. So you're basically going from birth up to about 3 years of age. This is what it looks like if you're between 200 and 400% of the federal poverty level. And this is what it looks like if you're 200% below the poverty level. That's just measuring volume, right? Hundreds of kids were in the study, longitudinal. So it wasn't like some kids at the age of 5 months and some kids at the age of 10. These are the same children who were measured over time. If you look at language development, the curves look identical. By 18 months, there's no difference between a child who's in a family where there are no high school graduates or high school graduates or college graduates. At 18 months, they look identical, about 20 or 30 words. By 24 months, there's twice as many words in the child in an environment in which there are college graduates. And by 36 months, that's a pretty short period of time, it's already 400% different between the child at 3 years of age in a college family and those who are in a family in which there is not a high school graduate. That's just the number of words. So whether you're looking at brain architecture or output, to tell me what this actually means in terms of output, this is what it means. And we can talk about this. There are a number of reasons why, number of factors why it's producing this kind of brain architecture. So the other thing I want to emphasize, which is one of the key points, is that social, emotional, and cognitive skill building are interconnected. Here's your neuroanatomy lesson for the day. You see all those beautiful structures up there in blue, green, red. They're involved in fear. Those are the fear and anxiety circuits that we have. You know, it's important to have some fear and anxiety to recognize danger and to be able to respond in an appropriate way. Did you guys pay less money for your seats on the side, by the way? The Supreme Court State Justice, she's on the side over there. Yeah. You need a better seat. Sorry. Okay, here are the circuits that are involved in cognition, learning, and memory. Oh, they're the same. They're the same. Which is why we talk about this when toxic stress damages these structures, and these are highly vulnerable to toxic stress. These are the elements of function that get damaged. Both learning and memory abilities, as well as social emotional development. And they come together to form something that we call executive function, which has received a lot of attention, and which clearly in the context of the program that Art talked about, that's what is being targeted, particularly in adults as well as in children. You know, because of serve and return, Art's program that he talked about makes sense, because you're improving skill sets both in the adult who's interacting with the child and the child who's interacting with the adult. Programs that target just one component of that serve and return, it's like hitting a ball across a net and nobody's on the other side to return it, right? So what is executive function, the social, emotional, and cognitive skills that come together? Well, we look at them as like our air traffic controller who has to do a lot of things. You have to have attention. What are you attending to? And there's lots of things happening. You can't pay attention to everything. How do you filter out those things that really don't matter for the moment, right? You have to make some critical decisions in a short period of time. So this is a skill. You learn how to attend to the most important things for the job that you're going to do at the moment, right? You have working memory. Oh, you keep in mind what's happening. Where is that plane up in the air at this period of time? Where's it going to be 30 seconds from now? You have long-term memory that you have to access in milliseconds to say, oh, I've done this before. This is the routine that I use, right? You have to control your emotions. If you freak out while you're making all these decisions, what's the outcome going to be, right? And you've seen this. You've seen this with your colleagues. You've seen this with children. Poor emotional control disrupts everything. Then you have some sort of an action. Okay, so how do we test this? This is your time to shine. I always do this. Do I have enough time for this? Okay, I have enough time for this. Okay, so here are your instructions, and you have to do this, including the Supreme Court justice. Okay, so here are your instructions. Read them. Read your instruction. Out loud, please. Okay, say the name of the color that the word is printed in. Can you guys see this over there? Okay, are you ready? Shout it out. Red. Of course I had red first. Badger red. Red.
Green. Black.
Orange.
I was ready. I knew it was coming.
There you go. Impulse control. Impulse control. It's hard to follow instructions when you have a pattern. And if your patterns of controlling your emotions and inhibiting some responses while having to do some action that makes sense for the moment. You have to learn those as a skill set. So that's part of executive function. Early executive function disruption equals long-term expensive problems. Let me give you some examples. This is a study published in 2011. If you look on the y-axis, poor health outcomes. On the bottom, you can see in red, low EF, low executive function in individuals, high executive function individuals. These are individuals that were studied beginning at the age of 5 months. They're now 30 years old. This is the famous Dunedin study. And they didn't look at IQ, because IQ is not impacted by any of this. Right? That measure is irrelevant. Right? It really is. Right? Here's what matters. So if you look at poor health outcomes, increased risk for cardiovascular disease, cancer, immune problems, obesity, diabetes, that's what's high up there. Low executive function early, measured in your first 2 years of life, that's what the outcomes are as adult, right? High executive function early, better health outcomes. If you look at adult criminal convictions, the curve looks identical. Low executive function early in the first few years, the predictions increase. There's about a fourfold increase in incarceration rates in those in those individuals, in those children when they grow up to be adults. This is Dunedin, right? Credit ratings. Why would you look at credit ratings? Well, it's a reflection of economic stability, the ability to be a participant in the community. Low executive function early, low credit rating as adult, etc. Look at adult wealth outcomes. Same thing. This all has to do with economic prosperity that Art talked about. If you look at positive parenting ratings, next generation, this is intergenerational if we don't do something now. Same thing, low executive function, your positive parenting will be low. Your ability to interact with your child, next generation, will be low.
Learning to deal with stress is an important part of healthy development. When experiencing stress, the stress response system is activated. The body and brain go on alert. There's an adrenaline rush, increased heart rate, and an increase in stress hormone levels. When the stress is relieved after a short time, or a young child receives support from caring adults, the stress response winds down and the body quickly returns to normal. In severe situations, such as ongoing abuse and neglect, where there is no caring adult to act as a buffer against the stress response stays activated. Even when there is no apparent physical harm, the extended absence of response from adults can activate the stress response system. Constant activation of the stress response overloads developing systems with serious, lifelong consequences for the child. This is known as toxic stress. Over time, this results in a stress response system set permanently on high alert. In the areas of the brain dedicated to learning and reasoning, the neural connections that comprise brain architecture are weaker and fewer in number. Science shows that the prolonged activation of stress hormones in early childhood can actually reduce neural connections in these important areas of the brain at just the time when they should be growing new ones. Toxic stress can be avoided if we ensure that the environments in which children grow and develop are nurturing, stable, and engaging.
So, we talk about three levels of stress to make sure that no one walks away with the idea that stress is bad. All stress is not bad. So there's what we call positive stress. Standing up in kindergarten or first grade to talk about what you did over the weekend. And of course, if you're the adults hoping that your child doesn't talk about things that they don't really want them to talk about in school. Right? Mild stress hormone increases. Tolerable, serious, temporary stress response is sometimes out of your control. A natural disaster, a loss of a loved one, etc. In buffer supportive relationships, those don't become toxic. So what are the sources of toxic stress? It was interesting, I was in Maine in October. I was fortunate to be set to sit next to the Chief Justice of the Supreme Court of Maine, one of your colleagues, she's wonderful. And she was talking about all the attention that's paid in family court to physical harm to child safety, which is what they focus on in terms of making their decisions, their family decisions, their foster care decisions. Well, here's actually what the data say. Neglect accounts for close to 80% of toxic stress, severe neglect. So well, how can the absence of something, just not paying attention, how can that damage brain architecture? How can that have such a large impact? Keep in mind what I said before. Serve and return is a core component of child and brain development. In the absence of that, the brain doesn't develop properly, and it actually has a big impact on brain architecture. Art mentioned the Romanian orphan study. I'm not going to show any of that data. It's all published. Enormous impacts on brainwave activity, on brain size, et cetera, et cetera. That's neglect, and that's where we are in terms of the source, about 80%. So here's one study I did want to show you. It's a little complicated. Essentially, if you have depression as an adult, and if you measure your low, if you measure maternal support that you had as a child, and you measure a part of the brain that's involved in emotional regulation and learning, the hippocampus, there's about a 20% difference in the size of the hippocampus if you were low on the maternal support and you're high on depression severity. That's that gold bar. That's that gold thing right there. If you're typical with high maternal support and low depression as an adult, you're about 20% larger. Now, 20% doesn't seem like a whole lot, but the difference in the size of the hippocampus, for example, between somebody typical or who has some mental health disorders like schizophrenia, the difference in size of the hippocampus there is 8%. Eight. So 20% difference in the size is enormous. Okay. At the level of the individual neuron, we know that toxic stress damages the connections. There are less connections that are made. In particular, the parts of the brain that are most vulnerable, the frontal lobe, is the part that's most important in developing executive functions. Right? Those executive functions early are predictive of what's going to happen later. I showed you that Dunedin data. And it's vulnerable because it continues to develop even through your 30s, right? Which is why we can do things in terms of targeting both adults and children in the program, for example, that Art talked about, where you can increase skills in these areas because those brain, that brain area is still developing, but it's also highly vulnerable to toxic stress. 10 minutes. No problem. So why does toxic stress have such long... It's a good thing my speech is more fluid now than it was when I was a child. Why does toxic stress have such long-lasting impacts? Well, there's something that we call signatures on genes, or what you've heard, maybe in the lay press or your colleagues at the University of Wisconsin who study this. There are several wonderful scientists, Richie Davidson and Ned Kalin, who may have talked before this group or to others, who study the impact of environment at a molecular level on your DNA. So you inherit genes from mom and dad. You say, well, that's what we get. That's how the genes work. Well, in fact, experiences can put chemical signatures on those genes just through experience. And bad experiences, toxic stress experiences, actually change the way that nerve cells get activated. They actually then put these little signatures or chemicals on the genes. And that can change permanently how the genes will function in adulthood. Changes that occur, believe it or not, and this was a mystery. This is true in animal studies that were done. It's now been shown in human studies that have been done. Some of these changes that occur at birth or even before, during pregnancy, will last for the individual for a lifetime. So, for example, there was a mystery about why all the data kept showing that risk for obesity increases during if there are pregnancies in which there is obesity during pregnancy. There's an increased risk. Increased risk for cardiovascular disease by enduring toxic stress as a two-year-old. How is that possible? This is how it's possible, by changing the way the genes that you inherit from mom or dad are actually used, and it's called epigenetics. So this is what we know. Normal brain plasticity, based on about 50 years of research, shows that early on, experience can greatly influence the development of the brain. So plasticity, or the ability to change, is very high. So, for example, a child born with amblyopia, patching the strong eye so that the weak eye is used, there's a period of time over which that works beautifully, after which it doesn't work very well at all because the plasticity of the system goes down. Well, it's not that you can't change over time or you can't change later, it just costs a lot more. What we call physiological effort is required to enhance neural connections. It may be the case that if you're 21 years old and you put on a pair of ice skates for the first time, you'll learn how to skate. And if you do it for 8 hours a day over the course of 5 years and don't do anything else, you may become as proficient as somebody who started earlier, or may not. But think about the amount of energy and time and effort that it would take just to come to the level of somebody who started much, much earlier, where the brain was getting wired up and learned that skill set early on. And that's really what Art was talking about. Why the effects of these programs, these 3- and 4-star programs, have such long-lasting effects. It's because of that curve. And we all know the story about second language proficiency. There are lots of gaps in terms of what we know and what we do. For example, school start time. What time does the average teenager want to wake up? Anybody want to?
Noon.
What time? What time does high school start here? 7:15. Yeah. What about your 7-year-old buzzing in your ear at 6:30 in the morning? Right. What time do they start school? 8:30, 9 o'clock, right? Boy, that makes a lot of, I mean, I can tell you there's a reason for that. It's not that, well, teenagers do like to cause their parents problems just for the heck of it, but there's a physiological reason why that is. This is another one, right? Language proficiency, learning a second language, goes down because those brain structures get wired up pretty early, and it's very difficult to rewire to be able to manage second and third languages. So here are some classic programs that work. Plan from pregnancy and look beyond education and healthcare. I'll talk about the home visitation program in a minute. Invest in the development and retention of a skilled workforce in early childhood and public education. Art mentioned this. This is really important. When I talk to business leaders about this, there are two things that we talk about. The revolving door of employees, that's number one on their list for things that they don't want to have to deal with, because it's very expensive to continue to retrain individuals doing a particular task in your business. My father owned a pharmacy when I was growing up, and I remember that he had two or three people who worked for him for 10, 15 years before they left. And I remember asking him when I started getting into this how he did that. He actually paid them a little more, sent them for some training that nobody else, other pharmacies wouldn't do, and they valued that, and they actually stayed with him, and it was so cost effective, he didn't have to retrain anybody. 5 minutes, okay, I'm almost done. Make sure vulnerable children have access to stable, supportive relationships with adults as early and consistently as possible. The only thing you really have to remember is how important serve and return is. If you remember that, then you'll understand why neglect is such a powerful source of toxic stress, and why the programs like what Art talked about and what you're going to hear in a minute, why they work. It's all based on this. So here are some clinically tested executive function interventions, and you're going to be surprised by what's on this list. This is programs that were targeted for 4- to 12-year-olds. Some of them are targeted for adults as well. Computerized training for increasing working memory. Some of those programs actually do work in young children. Reasoning and speed training. Certain kinds of skill sets that you can target, just like you do for athletes. Thank you. I have a residual cold. Aerobic exercise, which was one of the first programs eliminated from schools, right? But there's actually a neuroscience basis for this. When we exercise, we produce a number of substances in our brain, one of them called brain-derived neurotrophic factor, which we know now is important in rehabilitation medicine, which is important. This is why aerobic exercise is so important. It actually increases and strengthens nerve connections and how well they function. So we've identified the molecular and physiological basis for why this works in the brain. Martial arts, which can teach inhibitory control and mindfulness. And there's some curricular tools of the mind. There are others. I don't have any connection to any of these things. This is a beautiful review that was written in 2011 by Dell Diamond and Lee that talk about these. So remember, serve and return. If you look at the nurse family partnerships, which is a home visitation program that starts during pregnancy for at-risk moms, mostly single and young, the return on investment, which you've seen before, for the high-risk group is about $6 for every dollar that you invest, a 6-to-1. That's pretty remarkable in terms of return on investment. For the full sample, it's about $3. Most of the returns are to society, not to the individual. That's what's in blue. And there's a new study that's just come out by David Olds. This is David Olds' original program. A new study that was published where they looked at paraprofessionals participating in this as the visitation individual versus nurses. And the effects of paraprofessionals is negligible. So highly trained, skilled individuals doing this, participating in this program, matter a lot, right? And then Phil Fisher's work looking at multidimensional foster care intervention studies. If you look at one measure, right, the probability of a permanent and stable placement of a child in foster care, this is the number of different foster care placements they had prior to the study. If you use multidimensional therapeutic foster care, which is essentially targeting executive function skill building in the foster family, in the parents, right, as well as therapeutic targeting of the child, so both the foster family and the child are part of the targeted intervention. There's no difference in stabilities. The stability is almost absolute whether that child's been placed once or six times. In standard foster care, the chances of them being in a permanent stable relationship is directly related to the number of times previously that they've been moved from one foster home to another. So this is not inevitable. You can change this curve dramatically and think about the cost savings there as well as quality of life, both for the child and for the foster family. So remember, invest early. Major increase in human capital via ready workforce, and I'll still argue that it's the most patriotic thing that we can do. Thank you very much.